Welcome to Farming for Nature with me, Bridget Barry, where farmers across Ireland who have found a way to work with nature while saving money tell us how they have done it. James Gilmartin is a seventh generation part-time farmer in North County Leitrim. He farms cattle and sheep through holistic plan grazing and has carried out a number of actions to work out the natural carrying capacity of his land that works for him, for the animals, for nature and for his wallet. James, thanks for joining me today. You have an organic beef farm in North County Leitrim, of which you're the seventh generation. Wow. Can you just tell me about your own journey onto this farm?
Yeah, thanks very much for having us on, Bridget. Like you said, I'm a beef farmer here in North County Leitrim, an organic beef farmer, but not only an organic beef farmer. I inherited or kind of grew up farming with my dad and my uncle, Pat Lord of Mercingham. And they farm traditionally suckler beef and produce the weanling calf for market and then mid-season lamb and sheep. In the last few years, like when they would have grown up themselves, the farm was self-sufficient in the sense, you know, there was a huge diversity of animals and plants grown on the farm to kind of keep everyone going. But as time has gone on, you know, I could see the farm has been kind of focused more towards just, you know, producing sheep, producing beef, and that was it. Like, and you know, I mean, my dad's time, there was a pigsty on the farm, there was turkeys, there was hens. He told me a story. Every year he used to keep turkeys up to, like, he's 92 now, but up to he was about 85, he used to keep maybe 10 turkeys every year and keep them at Christmas and give them as presents. But he remembers when we were plucking them or whatever, he was saying when he was, so he was born in 1931. He remembers in the early 40s going up to a course in the local national school with his mother on how to rear poultry, you know. And all of these things are kind of gone from farms. Now, I'm not saying every farmer needs to be keeping pigs, growing their own vegetables, their own potatoes, their own cabbages, and you know, turkeys and hens, of course, which I didn't mention, and all the other things along with the sheep and cattle. But I kind of have a feeling that there is space for that in the agricultural arena at the moment. So I think that's sort of where my passion is, shall I say.
Okay, brilliant. And you grew up on the farm and inherited it. And how long have you been farming yourself?
Well, I guess, yeah, it's not. So I'm a teacher as well. I'm an agricultural science teacher here in Bundoran. And I've been teaching, I'm 44 now, so I'm teaching 22 years. I guess you go through different stages of life, a bit like the seasons of life. Seasons of the year, you know, when you're in your 20s, maybe football and holiday and having the fun of a 20-year-old, as one says, even though I was farming, but I wasn't overly engaged in it. Thankfully, my dad was able to run a fair bit at that stage. And my brother was farming as well. And my cousin Shane, he was, and his family were also helping out. So it was kind of a team effort. But I guess as I got settled and built a house at home, I got married to Joanne, and we've had three lovely, wonderful children. You kind of become more ingrained in it. So it's in the last 10 years, I would say, that I'm really kind of, I suppose, taking on the mantle of the lead farmer at the moment.
So you're a part-time beef farmer. Can you explain your farming system to me, James?
Yeah, well, the predominant amount of farmers in this part of the world, mainly male, but there are a lot of some female as well, are part-time due to the economics of it. So what I've developed on the farm today at the moment. So we produce beef. So we have suckler cows, and they would have a calf every year. We produce mid-season lamb and sheep. So they would have their lambs, you know, April time, early April, and then they would be sold on as either fat lambs in the end of summer or in the summer period, and anything that isn't appropriate way to sold to stores. And that's kind of the general gist that most farmers would do in the area. In the last while, as I mentioned, I've taken on poultry myself. So I have a small herd flock, should I say, of organic hens, roughly in there about 80-85 hens at the moment. So they're laying once a day, so I have a small market set up for that. I've kept turkeys this year as well, so it's my first year doing that. Wasn't my first year. I used to do it with my dad growing up, but I took on as a another diversification on the farm to keep 75 turkeys. And I have my own beehive, and from a production point of view, that'd be the animals end of it. The honey I don't really do for sale, but a key thing that I try to employ on the farm is how we manage the animals on the farm and the type of grazing patterns that we have engaged, and that they have a very, you know, happy life when they're in North Leitrim, so to speak, except for that one bad day. or 2 bad days if you're a boy, unfortunately, but that's the way it goes. Another thing I forgot to mention was we have a small dextra herd as well. We have them for a couple of reasons, but the main reason we would have is we have this commonage, which is attached to a farm. And for any of your listeners who aren't sure what a commonage is, it's sort of like it can be different types of ground, but generally it's a big open area that's attached to the townlands that abut the commonage. So it's sort of like up on a mountainside, or it can be off on a our particular one, it can be off by a seaside, or our particular one is a wet heath habitat. So it's full of this beautiful heather, which is in bloom. Earlier on in the year, now it's just kind of gone back now a bit. So you have cross heath heather, ling heather, bell heather. I'm not an ecologist now, but we are doing some work with ecologists on the mountain, seeing how it affects the cattle are affecting the grazing on the mountain. It's a really sensitive habitat up there. There's sphagnum moss, which of course, any of your listeners that understands carbon sequestration, it's a really important thing for turning into peat eventually, and for taking in all that carbon dioxide gas that's up in the air. But yeah, it's I can talk a bit more about it in a while if you wish. But that's kind of so you have all of these facets going on the farm, and they're kind of what the farm can produce. I guess the key thing is, as a farmer, like you have to take what you need from the land, but don't take what the land can't give. Like traditionally in farming, you know, going back maybe 50, 60 years, farms were divided up on the notion of a 2 cow farm, a 3 cow farm, you know, a 5 cow farm. You didn't go too much further than that. Now, take into account there were small holdings. But what's kind of happened now is these 5 cow farms, through intensification of farming, and I'm not trying to knock intensification, we have diversity issues or biodiversity issues at the moment because things get out of balance. You do need a balance in all your systems. But you've got this system where everyone is trying to push linear production of keeping as many cattle as possible when it doesn't really work out. Like there's a tipping point when the land can't take it. And look, we see the ecological disaster that's kind of in different parts of Ireland at the moment. You look at Lough Neagh, and I'm look again, this isn't why I'm on to talk about that, but it's sort of to give another option to farmers, especially young farmers out there. You know, maybe I can farm like this on the land.
And how did you learn about your kind of natural carrying capacity? What works for you? I mean, was it trial and error, or is there kind of a like an equation that you follow or anything like that?
Generally, if you look at your week, that's a fair indicator. Like you're talking about what the farm can carry, but there's a lot of variables involved as well. You know, I am part-time, as I said, so which I'm part-time at, I'm not sure. I'm actually part-time teaching this year, but I've always been farming. If you're stretched too far, that's a clear indication that there's something wrong. I think a key thing in farms is biodiversity and just looking with your eyes. So, for example, like, you know, I mean, there was one occasion, it's only a simple thing, but there not so long ago, I was coming down to this, you know, area that it's a high nature value area that we have in the farm. And there's a beautiful stream that kind of trickles its way down. And I was just coming around the corner, and there was this beautiful grey heron just perched on a rock. And I kind of looked at it, and it looked at me. And it was sort of like, I know it might sound a bit, what's the word, not highfalutin, but it was just like, if you have a predator that's there, that's that high up the food chain, like they have to be there for what's below them. There has to be enough of that, and that feeds on down the food chain. Because if you have these big predators, that's a really good sign that everything is healthy on the farm. So I guess it's not really. I never. We never got to the stage. We've always been very extensive, when it came to production. That you know, you see things going out of kilter, but that would be one instance that I can think of.
A nice observation, all right. And tell me,
Yeah.
you've been working in holistic plan grazing. I know that's one of the actions you do. How does this work for you? And can you explain it to the audience if people don't know what holistic plan grazing is?
Well, basically, it's based on Alan Savory, who kind of based his model and just looking. A lot of what we do is you're not trying to recreate something new or create something new. It's about recreating what has worked well in the past, and it's based on the concept of massive herds moving regularly. So if you look at the Midwest in America, like there was massive herds of buffalo traipsing across there, you know, on a daily move, like when you'd have predators like around the end, wolves and whatever else pushing them on. So they never waited too long in the one place, you know. But without being crude, the idea is if you can think of grasses that are about the height, 6 foot, right, tall, like in these big plains, and the animals in this big massive herd, they come in and they eat a third, they trample a third, and then they defecate on a third, like so the wee and urine and all the rest and the feces that are left behind. So if you just go back to this, the 2/3 or the 1/3 that they've eaten, they've grazed the top part of the plant, the leafy part of the plant, the guy that's full of sugar, and they've moved on and they've created living, what we would have now, farmyard manure. And that two-thirds gets converted into carbon, organic matter. So if you think of it like a sheet on your bed, you end up creating a duvet. Now, and look, I mean, out in the States, in some of the places, they measured down how deep the soil went, and it went down like up to 2 meters, like huge depths of organic matter, which is like what you need for growing grass. So, and there's a whole method behind that without getting too scientific about it, but it's the plants feed the soil biology through giving them their sugars in the form of root exudates, like this liquid, and then the soil biology releases the minerals, and it goes round and round and round. And it's kind of like, it's the circle of life, if you want to, for want of a better word. So where am I going with this? On our farm, you recreate the same things. So for example, with the hens, I've got 50 meter electric fencing that I put around the hens. They've got this mobile unit that they go into at night, and you move it as regularly as possible. It is holistic plant grazing. So I'd remove it every 2 days with the amount of hens I have and the amount of space that they have. But realistically, it's more 4 or 5 days because of time constraints on my end. But at the same time, I'm never bearing soil. I'm feeding they're scratching away, they're scraping the soil, and then you're moving on the whole thing. The same process can be applied to your cattle, to your sheep. The predators is the electric fence, as I said, and that's, you know, it's quite a, you end up seeing, I'm only in the early stages, I'm really only practicing over a year, but you can see benefits with that.
That's really interesting, because the other thing that you're trialing and you're quite new to is virtual fencing. Can you explain again to the listener and to me what this is and how it benefits your farm and how you're using it on your farm?
Sure. So I'm trying to make it okay. So the commonage that I mentioned earlier on is this big, vast area. I think it's like 148 hectares, which equates to over 300 acres of wet heat commonage that we have access to. We have a share on it. We can't put all our animals up there, but we can put a certain amount. And I guess I was looking out the window one evening, and I happened to be reading a piece in the paper about how they were trialing this GPS, global positioning system, collar, on Highland cattle in the Highlands in Scotland. And I was like, well, you know, if they can trial it in Scotland in the Highlands, why can't they trial it in this beautiful mountain up in North Leitrim? So I put together an application to the National Parks and Wildlife, and they were very happy to support it. So we purchased 5 collars initially, and we put them on the Dexter cows. Couple of reasons, again, with the Dexters, the commonage up there wouldn't be the most, well, what we would think nowadays as nutritious grass, but you know, if you stick with me for a minute, you'll see it doesn't cause them any harm, and in fact it helps them a lot. So up in the commonage, you set your boundary, which is a theoretical boundary on your phone or your iPad or whatever you want to use, and this boundary then is linked to the collar. So before you put the cattle up in the commonage, you put them into a field with the same boundary, just a line, and as the cattle approach the line, they get a beeping noise on the collar, and the beeping intensifies as the closer they get to the line. Now, when they're in their training zone, as soon as they get to the line, they'll break through because they get an electric shock, a slight one. Now, I don't even know if it's strong enough, if I'm honest, but that's not my area of expertise. Yeah, it's not. It's, you know, because I've seen it work with some cattle, and with others, it doesn't knock a bat out of them. So again, but then that's temperament too. So they break through the line, but eventually they come back across the line, and then they come to it the next time, and the beep, beep, beep will occur, and eventually they become trained to it. And it doesn't take very long. I mean, I think most animals get it within 2 goes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a careful thing about the animal, if you go back to the start, you want the animal to be happy on your land. If they were getting regular shocks, your phone, you get notified to your phone, and then that's the case, well, that animal isn't going to be suitable for using that. I haven't had that yet, but that's, you know, that's the thing to be aware of. So we put them up in year one, and we just grazed them for approximately 6 weeks in the summer. Again, I mentioned earlier on, it's a very sensitive ecosystem. So with the sphagnum moss and this beautiful bog myrtle as well, it's got this lovely smell when you break it. That the heathers that they have up there. Now, there's a huge amount of purple moor grass, or millennia grass, I believe it's called. And it needs, like, it's the cattle just go up and they love that. And coupled with that, the bog myrtle and holly, I've seen them eating holly. They've seen them eating a variety of different foods. Now, the cattle that were eating it weren't, shall we say, in bad condition. They were very, very healthy looking. But there was obviously something in these foods. No more. And there's willow up there as well. For any of your listeners that would be aware, in Ireland, the willow is the sally rod, which comes from the Latin salix, which I think is S-A-L-C-Y-X, I think. which is the which the reason salic, sorry, gives the name to salicylic acid, which is in willow. And for any of your farmers out there that know, the salicylic acid is actually aspirin. So it's self-medicating for the cows to eat the willow, and they love it, and they'll not eat too much of it. Actually, this year I made some tree hay, which was a case of, you know, cutting willow with my students at school, and we gave it to some cattle on the farm, and they definitely liked it. But anyways, I'm going off track with the GPS. So that's sometimes what happens when you get talking, right?
There's a beep going off now. I'm beeping. Beep, beep.
You're beeping. Got it. Super.
I'm only joking. I'm only joking. This is the virtual fencing.
Yeah, oh, you're, of course, yeah. So it's worked really well. In year three, we've just come into year three. There's a girl, the National Parks and Wildlife are subsidizing a PhD student from the University of Santa Barbara to do a study, and we've had one season over us where she's we've put up four Dexter cattle in one plot, a control plot, and then four what would be more traditional breeds, Shorthorns and Angus, in the other plot. And she spent a full 6 weeks in the summer daily watching them graze. After they'd leave, she'd go in and do an assessment of what they've eaten, collecting their poop. My wife is like, when is this lady? And she's very fond of her coming for our poop, because our freezer is half full with our poop, but or the cow's poop, should I say. But yeah, that's it. But it's really interesting because you've got these resources on the farm. Cattle traditionally would have been grazed up on these through a variety of reasons. They've come off the hills, and there's obviously a negative impact with that as well, because, you know, certainly certain grasses, the heathers are starting to take over, the purple moorgrass, grass, which I mentioned earlier on. Everything has to be kept in balance, and the herbivore definitely has a function in that.
That's really interesting. As you say, it's kind of it's moving everything in balance, and then when you come back down to the lowlands, those dexters then are part of your kind of bigger ecosystem down there. Tell me, what else are you doing on your farm in terms of building up your kind of your biodiversity, like hedges, wildlife corridors, that type of thing?
Yeah, we're part of the new acre scheme, so we're currently in the process of applying. Actually, there's training going on the farm today, currently. But one thing we're going looking at is putting in a riparian zone, which, for simple terms, is a 3 meter exclusion ro zone close to a river which goes through the farm. And in that, so basically, when you plant 3 meters away from the edge of the water, I mean, no animals can access that. So straight away, you're saving on erosion, because sometimes cattle will go to the side and they'll go into the, obviously, the drinking into the river, and that can cause issues in itself, but it'll also stop soil being pushed into it. Coupled with that, inside in the riparian zone, we're going to plant a row of trees of different types, native trees, because their function will be to hold the nutrients that come off the farm that's going towards the river, to catch that, bring it up, grow good timber, suck out the carbon dioxide out of the air. Keeping it fairly simple now, convert that to timber, and keep the whole thing in as much as you can control these things. I mean, it's biomimicry you're trying to do, as in copying nature, but you need to remember, you know, you can't control nature. I mean, it's not and I think that's what, you know, as a species, humans kind of probably need to keep reminding themselves, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely happier when you kind of let it do its thing.
Yeah, the
So
whole
you
load of
also.
benefits with that riparian zone. You've got, you know, you'll have thatch coming up, you'll have places for ground nesting birds, you'll have biodiversity, you'll have, you know, initially the idea, eventually, for any of your listeners, you know, if farmland is left and nothing is done with it, eventually it'll go back to a forest. But there's different steps along that progression. Like, it'll go to bramble, and, you know, the pioneer species like alder and willow will come into it, and then your bigger guys will come along, like your oaks. But there's a whole, you know, there's a cycle there again, I think.
You
It's
mentioned
kind of,
earlier you also keep bees. How's this feed into your whole system?
yeah, well, that started, I was a pre-COVID and during COVID, I suppose, experience. So, as I mentioned, I'm a teacher. I do a TY module with my class called TY Regenerative Agriculture. I'm careful to talk about regenerative as well, because it's a word that's kind of been hijacked by mainstream industry now. So it's small scale regeneration on a small scale basis on farms. But I had hoped to keep a hive at school, but it hasn't just worked out that way for a few reasons. But a lady close by will forget more about bees than I will ever know. She's a wonderful beekeeper, a German lady named Monica. And she took me under her wing during COVID, when we were allowed, of course, and social distance and all the things that were there. She just lives around, like, not very close to the house. I better get the direct the distance right. There was a certain distance we were allowed to travel, but it was within that. And that's when I learned about bees. So I have two hives at the moment. Each hive produces a roughly, depending on the year, like the first year, I think I got 70 jars per hive. This year, actually, for anyone that remembers, May was a wonderful month. The whitethorn was in full blossom. Like, I mean, incredibly well. And the hives were packed. And I was thinking, God, I'm going to have a bumper year. But then, of course, the weather broke. But the bees had hunted for themselves. Now, fair play. They ate most of it, which is fine too. You're only trying to extract what you need from them. And then leave them some, but yeah, I on so many levels, it's mindful kind of work too. Like it's not, I don't do it for a production on the farm at the moment. I mean, it is something that you could do, but then you have to remember your own running and racing. Like you know, do you have priorities? Your family being the most important, and then after that, you kind of have to, you know, tend your time appropriately. But yeah, two hives is well manageable, you know. Yeah.
And where would you start advising another farmer if they wanted to consider putting, like, including more nature onto their farm? What are the main things from what you've done and what you've learned? What are the main things to consider? I mean, you mentioned time management there would be an
Yeah.
important factor for you. What are the other things the main things to consider
But I
for
would ask
farming
you a
alongside
question.
nature?
I'll ask you a question then. What would you consider to be a barrier to a farmer that isn't, I suppose, that's considering this? I mean, maybe I'm going to put what you call a rhetorical question. Like, what would you think? I mean, you're going to say money is one thing. But to do all these actions takes money, regardless of what way you look at it. Time is a massive issue. There is a notion, though I think people are starting to understand more and more that you may lose income by doing it, that you're losing productive land. But in reality, that rarely is the case, unless, you know, I mean, if you go from the very opposite of it, let's say you wanted to make it into an absolute barren monoculture desert of just, you know, perennial ryegrass, take out all your hedges, take out everything. And again, I'm not trying to, you know, be the, what would you call it, sage on the stage here saying I know it all and I know everything, but there are balances in place. I think a big thing is for all farmers, be them from whatever walk of life, is to be conscious first and foremost that you're connected to the land. There's very few farmers really just see it as a business and don't care, look, I buy, sell, whatever, like a capitalist market or whatever. If you're connected to the land, and for the most of us, we've been very fortunate to inherit good farms from our predecessors, whoever they were before, and it's incumbent on us down the line to leave it in better shape for your, you know, people coming after your descendants and what else, and whether they be your own family or whoever it is. So going back to the very start, get a context of what it is you have. What do you want to do for future generations? The world isn't a great place when old men plant trees they'll never sit under, you know, and like that's kind of, I think it's some proverb I heard somewhere. You have to kind of think that way. Then the basics, let's get the economics, get involved with an environmental scheme like Acres. Get onto Farming for Nature website. Like, I mean, I as I said, I'm 10 years farming. 2017, 2018, I think he got going. I mean, I have a guy, you know him, Bridget, Tommy Early. Tommy is like this hero to me in relation to the Farming for Nature space. Like, Tommy would be one of the first guys, that one of the radicals. This what did I say? Today's radicals is
Pioneer.
tomorrow's pioneer. Yeah, today's radicals is tomorrow's conservatives. But Tommy, you're watching the videos, talking to him. To me, that just, it kind of fills your heart. You know what's right, you know. And again, you can be highfalutin with all the talk, and you know, go and do it too. Like, but get the money from an environmental scheme. Follow Farmer for Nature videos. Come and talk to you. You have a wonderful program there called the Hare's Corner. It's not the Hare's Corner, but you have that too. But
The
what's the one
horse's
when
mouth. The
the
horse's
horse's
mouth
mouth?
mentorship.
What a wonderful program! Like, I mean, you can apply to the horse's mouth to get a Farmer for Nature ambassador to come to your farm and see what can be done, or just give you a bit of hope. Do you know what I mean? Like, the biggest problem, and this is my dad, was a great thing. If you have a job to do, just go at it, but know why you're doing it. And you know, and sometimes just maybe go a bit slower too. That's something I always have to concentrate on and kind of take it all in, because yeah, we're very, very fortunate. So I hope
Yeah,
that
it's really
answers it.
it does answer it. Thank you. It sounds like you're farming with natural instincts. I mean, you've obviously had good guidance in the past, but I mean, like you say, it's really important to kind of observe the results and change direction if you need to. James, you're a pretty busy person with a young family and being a teacher, but it sounds like you enjoy being a part-time farmer and it's all manageable. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah, maybe if we got my wife on here, she mightn't agree with me. But, no, I shouldn't say that. Man, it's fully in support of me, but it does. It's a team effort. That's something that's very. And my wife is a, she's a teacher as well. She's a principal in the local national school. But like farmer, I'm Gilmartin is my surname, but my mum is Catley Mitchell. Oftentimes, the women in the families are kind of they're a critical part of the family, and part of the farm and setup. So that can't be forgotten about either. It's a team effort on a farm. It's not an individual's run, runs at it, so to speak, But you're working it. If you're passionate about something and it makes you feel good, and you just I don't know. I guess when you slow down, you don't have sometimes just words kind of don't do things justice. You just it's a good feeling to be doing these things, and if something feels good, it generally is good,
James, what would you like to see? What's your ultimate ideal future for farming?
There's no such thing as perfection, and if you follow kind of the 80-20 rule, where if you get 80% of what you do right, correct, you're not doing too bad. But going that direction is, I suppose, producing local food. Nowadays, people find it very hard to get local food that's produced for local communities from the land that's in and around that community. I mean, everyone goes to the shop now and buys meat and buys whatever, but they don't really know where it's coming from. Now, I'm not saying there isn't a place for that as well, but opportunities for communities to build through supporting young farmers who like to farm in this kind of way. Like, I'm always wary to kind of like label people, you have to be a certain way to farm this way. But there's certain values that a farm should have to produce the type of food. I guess, sure, it goes back to what happened before. Families are fa farm and families produce enough food on the farm to feed themselves, first of all, and the surplus went into the community and whichever way it was sold. If you're producing it for yourself, there in itself is a good enough indicator that it's a top quality, nutrient dense product that hasn't been, interfered with chemicals that might, cause harm that we either do know about or we don't know about. So yeah, if I was to go one way, local based communities, like, I mean, I'm in Manor Hamilton. It's important to me that local people there, that and they come back to you. They're like, them eggs you gave me, they were just like, I mean, when's the last time they'd say I had to break the yolk, when you crack the egg to fry it, or where you crack it to scramble it, and like I'd break the yolk to scramble it, and I'm not trying to say whatever, like I'm comparing myself to someone else. You're given something good, and that someone else is taking back from that, and to improve that opportunity. There's lots of money about the people who will be willing to support them kind of opportunities, and they're small scale industries. It's not for me to be running off and trying to set up 10 farms around the place making money. I do my bit. Mary down the road has an opportunity. She's coming out of college. She'd like to take 5 acres off dad to do this. Sean up the road can do the same thing if you follow me, and then you build communities that way. I think there's definitely a scope for that going forward.
James and Martin, thanks very much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Bridget. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Keep up the good work.
That's it. You can listen to Farming for Nature on farmingfornature.ie or wherever you get your podcast. Please share, rate, and review. It really helps us spread the word. And if you'd like to get in touch, email me on info@farmingfornature.ie. Until next time.